Africans at home and throughout the diaspora. Unity is strength. We've got the power.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now's the time to do the right thing.
We need more unity. Come.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now's the time to do the right thing.
In the spirit of Umoja, embrace with love.
That's right. That's right. We are going to do it right. Can you hear me, my guest? Good, good, good. This is Jamala Rogers, your host of Voices from the Battlefield. And it's been a good weekend. Lots of stuff happening as usual. I'm going to start with the good stuff. We had over the weekend, we roasted Wiley Price. And if you don't know Wiley Price, he's the photojournalist for the St. Louis American Weekly, one of the largest Black weeklies in our city, award-winning. And this brother has won some awards. So he ended 45 years of service with the St. Louis American. And so we had to send him off in good style, but we're gonna miss him, but I don't think he's far away. People will see his work all around. He did the iconic picture of President Obama here with all of the clergy laying hands on him. You see some of his photographs in my books. And so he's just been very generous with his work. And so I really love that brother, just a good brother. I didn't get this memo, but there was some skaters that rolled into town over the weekend. That's okay, Skate Masters USA. If you had sent me a memo, we would have had a really good welcoming from you from St. Louis, but we're glad you rolled in here and it seemed like you had a really great time. I attended the Black Men Read over the weekend. I was especially there to support Christopher Pate, one of my young people who's gone through a lot, but seems to be coming up out of that particular hole. But yeah, one of the things that was interesting about, they have five people, I think this was their first books, five brothers. And one of the interesting themes was that they all felt very vulnerable when writing that book, their books. And I can only imagine because Black men have felt like they've had to have layers of stuff so that they don't hide that vulnerability. They don't hide the tears and the sadness and the anger. I mean, most of the time the anger comes out, but not the sadness. So, yeah, that was an interesting piece to hear those brothers' stories. So I didn't get to stay until the end, so I don't know where you can get those books. But if I find out, I'm going to let you know. You know I will. But this is a time that I remind you that there is still genocide going on in Gaza. There is still a pathological liar in the White House, a 34-count felon. We can't say that he's a pedophile, but we certainly can say that he is a guardian of the pedophiles. But we see that the MAGA minions are in total disarray, but they also have us, our lives in total chaos as well. And so when we go to the pump, that represents the actions and policies of the Trump administration. We are now in 2 months of a war that was supposed to end in a couple of days. Remember y'all that excursion they talked about? Yeah, it's costing us upward to $2 billion a day. That's billion with a B. And not only does that make us vulnerable to the economic crises in the world, but it puts us in physical harm. Because when you start bombing other countries, they have a right to protect themselves and defend themselves. And so you think about what that's going to mean for us. And so it's a chaotic time, but I think, you know, when you hear from people like my guest that's coming on in a few minutes, you know that the struggle continues, it's intensifying. And as we move towards the midterm elections, I'm in no way thinking that's some kind of panacea. But we see the elections that have happened, the blues, the Dems have been able to get all but one. That should represent some transformative motion. I don't have all that faith in the Democrats because, you know, there's corruption in both parties. But we do have some foot, some skin in the game with some of those, because those folks are local, which means we might even live next door to them. We might even go to the same church as them. So we'll be tapping them on their shoulders to say, what have you done for us lately? So I know we had a court ruling based on the Louisiana case. We've talked about here our case of map rigging in Missouri. So we get ready to go through that ourselves. But that court in Louisiana, you know, favored the whole rigging of it, and they're about to eliminate the whole racial component of Section 2, which if you don't have Section 2, you really don't have a Voting Rights Act. So let's keep an eye on that. I know it's going to get appealed, but we should also be watching out what's going to happen in our own respective states. Having said that, we know that the states have really been doing some phenomenal stuff just in response to all of the chaos, the threats of authoritarianism. And no state has been more in the forefront than Minnesota. And they're not in the forefront now. We talked about this before it came on air. Sometimes we think things aren't happening just because they're not in the news, but I can assure you things are still happening in Minneapolis. So before I introduce my guest, I want to give you a little bit of geography so you know Minneapolis, St. Paul. So just like here in St. Louis, we have a river that separates us from East St. Louis. So you just go across the bridge and you're in another state. That's not the case in Minnesota. They're still in the same state, but across the river, one part is Minneapolis and across the river is St. Paul. They call those the twin cities. So I know I heard from people that say, well, where are all the Black folks? Well, let me just tell you the racial composition of Minneapolis. It's about 80% white. And if you've ever been there in the wintertime, you know why people of the sun will normally gravitate towards that state. But they are there, as well as Hmong people, as well as indigenous people, they are there. And so we'll get to hear a little bit more about that. But I just want to contextualize it for you that when you look at the images and you see like lots of white people in motion and maybe a few scattered people of color, you know why. 80% white. But it is a blue state, so the Democrats got some advantages over there. I want to now turn to my guest today, and I'm glad Trey Horn could join us because we were kind of getting nervous there for a minute, Trey Horn. But we have Rose Brewer, and Rose is, I've known Rose since the Black Radical Congress days, but she is a longtime radical activism scholar, an internationalist. She's a professor at the University of Minnesota, in the Department of African American and African Studies, but she's got deep roots in Minneapolis. She's been there a while. And in fact, I might have been when I first met her. There was in Minneapolis. It was in the winter time, so I remember very vividly. But we also are part of Black Midwest Initiative, and so I'll be seeing Rose in a couple of weeks as we talk about the environmental justice project that group is doing. So welcome to the show, Rose. And we have Marika Pfeffercorn, who is interesting background, but she's with the Twin Cities Innovation Alliance, the No Tech Criminalization, which is the acronym is NOTICE. And so I'm hoping she will be able to tell us a little bit more about what's happening with surveillance, the technology, what we need to be watching for. So I'm sure you saw lots of methodologies that they were using on the streets of Minneapolis during the greatest part of the siege. And then we have Trey Horn Cruz. Trey Horn accidentally popped in on one of our shows because I messed up with the date. So he already did his cameo, but he is a community organizer there in St. Paul. And he helped to initiate the St. Paul Recovery Act, the Minnesota Migration Act, and is one of the founders of the Black Lives Matter chapter there. And how I got connected with Trey Horn is he's active with the reparations movement there. And I tapped into my friend in Kansas City to say, who's in St. Paul? And he said, I got an activist there that's doing reparations work, because he is too. He hooked me up to Trayhorn. So welcome, Trayhorn. Welcome, Marissa. And you all can take your mute off so we could hear you. But yeah. So the first question I have for all of you all is, what does the community look and feel like right now since we've seen Bombini pushed out? We still had the czar come in, Holman come in with his antics. But what is the community feeling and looking like right now? Anyone can answer that.
I don't mind starting. I think it has been a pretty traumatic experience for the community. I think the positive aspect is that people are still in solidarity with one another, that they're still supporting one another. And I know Marika is going to talk about the mutual aid work that continues to go on. I have a lot more to say about why that continues to be necessary in the context of people needing state support and local support, including rent support, and that's a whole nother conversation, housing. The impact of MetroServe, Operation MetroServe, is much broader economically than was ever put out there. But folk are resilient, and ICE is not completely gone. They're still deporting people. We have an airport that every Thursday they take people away. And of course, they gravitated to the broader part of the state. So although there is a little bit of quietude, don't be fooled. I'll stop there.
Okay. What is it looking like from your standpoint,
Where to start?
Marika?
The pace has shifted, but it is a constant stream of rapid response that is still happening. Whether it is, was it just yesterday where they just raided a whole bunch of childcare centers and Somali small businesses? And so folks had to be out patrolling and watching to see what was happening. And it was in cooperation across federal, state, and city, so county. So what we see is an ongoing challenge with the cooperation of our leadership, particularly at the city level, in addressing public safety. We're seeing an erosion of the rights of the city council in competition with the mayor. We still see young people needing rides to and from schools because their families have been de detained and they're still trying to engage in their education. We still have to have families that get groceries dropped off to them because they still can't come out safely. And the indictments still stand against, is it 39 of our local activists right now? Yeah, there's no reprieve from the pressure. So the fight continues, and I'll pass it to Trayhorn.
So Trayhorn, I know that you are part of the folks who were arrested and pleaded not guilty. So this is a good segue for you to talk about what that looks like, because I think for some of us outside of Minneapolis, we're thinking, okay, given the climate and what happened, all of those people should receive amnesty. That apparently is not the case. What's going on with that?
I think that with Pam Bondi, there's a new new head of the Department of Justice right now. I think his name is Blanche or Todd Blanche right now. And so I think some of the things that weren't moving as quickly before, I'm going to start moving a little faster now. So you see the 22 raids coming up. We have been waiting for discovery for a long time in our case, and we just got that yesterday. From the Department of Justice just sent out the discovery in the case. So they're still going to be moving, pressing forward with some of the unjust legal maneuvers that the Department of Justice and this administration is targeting, especially the leadership in Minnesota.
So Trayhorn, is there, are you all lumped together? Are you trying to lump yourself together for to in terms of defense? Because I can't even imagine what it means for each one of you to try to get your own attorneys and all of that. Who is defending you all, and what is sort of the community outreach for defense of the folks who stood up and got arrested?
We have had a lot of community support, but by law, I believe we do all have to have separate counsel. So all 39 defendants do have their own lawyers, all of our own lawyers. Some of us have federally appointed prosecutors, and some might have like a private attorney. But that's what that's looking like, and I think we'll probably see things start moving along in that more quickly too. And on the other side, we're hoping to see some forms of accountability from some. I know the Hennepin County attorney just filed charges against the ICE agent for pointing a gun at somebody not too long ago. So there are some things that Minnesota is doing to continue to try to fight back with against some of the stuff that happened here.
And you all have a black attorney general, Keith Ellison. I know he's got some charges against some of the stuff. How is that going, and how is it going to affect you all's individual cases?
I don't think that it's going to impact us necessarily. But I don't know exactly how his charges deal with what's happening with with the protests at the church. But I know there's just a lot of back and forth going on with the federal government, and it seems like the federal government is putting pressure on our local government to cooperate with the federal government, and I think that's why we've seen those 22 raids yesterday.
Yeah, no surprise with that. I want to go to you, Rose, because you're at the university, and I know some of the universities have been under, scare and intimidation based on the DEI. What has been the response of the university system there to all these raids and to what's going on with the community? Have they been proactive? Have they been quiet? What's been their role?
Indeed, it's been the students who've been at the forefront. The Graduate Student Union was one of the first unions in the state to speak up to respond to the raids. The administration, as with most of these institutions, is inept, quiet, not taking a stand, trying to accommodate. So it's students, and not only the graduate students, but undergraduate students, as has been typical across the country, have taken a very tough stand. Of course, we are in a situation where we have students who are at risk and who have been at the center of ICE raids. And they're not honoring any kind of requests, or they didn't honor any kind of requests. We can't come in to this room, this building, et cetera. They proceeded to do so anyway. I wanted to say a little bit more about Ellison too, in terms of what's going on. In fact,
Please do.
they have brought a suit against all of Department of whatever they call it, Homeland Security, and including whoever is in control right now. They recently, just this past week, modified that suit. The overarching point is that it was illegal, that it's unconstitutional, and it violates several aspects of the Constitution. Now, this is the legalistic thing that Trayhearn was talking about, but it's a 260-page document that talks about all the consequences of ICE coming into the state without being asked to do so. So that's in the making. They also, of course, point out that it is not legal for the state to be superseded by the actions of the federal government in this instance. I also agree that given the response of Walz, who is the governor, but won't be, he's not running again, to this most recent raiding again, mainly Somali childcare centers, that it was very weak, saying that the state had already, they don't, the state doesn't tolerate fraud, et cetera. So it was, back to Tehran's point, just really a kind of capitulation on his part, but not everybody agreed with that. I'll leave it at that.
So in turn, go ahead, Marika.
I want to piggyback on Attorney General also. So I actually was in one of involved in one of the detentions that happened in the Twin Cities in my neighborhood, and was able to film the unlawful detention of my neighbors. And so community members across the country, and I'm sorry, across the city, the cities were all submitting those videos to the Attorney General and the ACLU for also for individual cases against I was pepper sprayed. And so they are and they it was right before they gave permission to do without doing identification without the warrant. So within those 3 days, I was one of the first people that was pepper sprayed. And so that became a critical part of a case because they legally had been told not to interfere, that the whistling, the observation was all legal, and then they violated that. So many of those videos are coming together for individual prosecution of ICE and federal agents.
Wow. It does make me think about, and I think you might have led off with this, Rose, the trauma of all of these things happening, of seeing community members and neighbors being shot dead on national TV, and what that means to the psyche of people, even if they weren't physically there. And one of the things that we know from the Ferguson uprising, and then most notably the tornado here that affected a historically predominantly black neighborhood, that trauma is often a part of what people feel, even if they don't understand it or know it. And I'm wondering, in the case of Minneapolis, were there some attention paid to that? And were they their responses in terms of, agencies or caretakers who could address that issue?
Yeah, I think it is unusual to think about a whole city or cities in the case of Minneapolis and St. Paul. But I think Marika is going to talk more about that. Young people are still having to be driven to school. Their parents are no longer with them. They've been deported. I'll let her speak to that. Communities are in disarray. When you can't pay your rent, that brings something into your body that you may not recognize as being a consequence of, I call it a police state, and I wanted to speak to that, that this isn't an exceptional action. It's a part of a broader racial state that is conditioning people to be in fear, as well as not to resist and not to protest. And back to your point, we hold it in our body in a way that we may not recognize as such. But we're still dealing with George Floyd.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. Trayhorn, you've been dealing with some of the reparations piece. Is this going to be some added ammunition as justification for why reparations is needed even for the state of Minneapolis?
Well, that's why we have the Minnesota Migration Act is the bill that it's not law yet, but it's something that we're advocating for at the state. At the state, really, it's a balance because you don't want to put one, so like there's the what happened to Black Americans, right? But right now at the legislature, there's not really a lot of bills that are focusing on that, and then the session's about to come to an end. Just today, somebody was killed by police in Richfield this morning in Minneapolis. And so we still haven't addressed what happened to Amir Locke. He was assassinated by Mark Hanneman. And there's a lot of instances where people, we had Ricky Cobb, he was killed by a state trooper here in Minnesota. That case was dropped. And so there's a lot of unresolved issues that happened before Operation ICE happened that we feel like if those issues were addressed before this, we wouldn't even be kind of be in this situation right now. We're still dealing with CPS, Black children, Black whose ancestors descend from U.S. chattel slavery. Their children are still being taken from them at a disproportionate rate. We have Minnesota has the big one of the biggest racial wealth gaps in the United States, some of the biggest income gaps in the United States, some of the biggest health disparities in the United States. And this was all before Operation Metro Surge, and there's no, and it's not being addressed at the state level in a proper manner. And so it continues to keep, even when Operation Metro Surge leaves, that's going to happen. We had a $20 billion surplus in 2020, and they chose to pay off stadiums or whatever and didn't address the racial wealth gap. So mass incarceration, we're still dealing with mass incarceration. We just talked about George Floyd, people being killed. So those are some issues that definitely we're saying, and a lot of other people are saying, that if we would address those issues first, we wouldn't even have Operation Metro Surge. Right now, there's a $100 million bill for businesses who were hurt during Operation Metro Surge. And we think definitely, and they said Operation Metro Surge costs those businesses close to $600 million. But we know that racism has cost the United States close to $16 trillion. And that needs to be addressed also. And right now, like we're saying, those who should be addressing it are not addressing it. So we think if we deal with that, I think we can deal with both at the same time. And it shouldn't put us against, you know, put one group against the other or something like that, that we should take a holistic approach to it. And there's still time left in this session to get a reparatory justice package for Black Americans in the state of Minnesota move forward to address. Dred Scott was here during military in bondage and military slavery at Fort Snelling. And just recently, myself, Chantel Allen, a lot of other Black activists were also in prison at Fort Snelling, where Dred and Harriet Scott were enslaved and were. So I do think there are some places where it does come together when we're talking about a part of international standard of reparations is cessations and guarantees of non-repetition. So when we're talking about state sanctioned violence, whether it's from ICE, the police, the sheriff, definitely I think there's a case to be made.
And I just want people to hear all the connections, because people here in St. Louis and Missouri know about the Dred Scott, because it was actually here in the courts. So we know that they were, but some people don't know that they were at Fort Snelling, but that's a connection. We also know that the United Nations just did the apology and saying that, you know, enslavement of African people needs to be addressed. And so here we are having that to undergird some of the work that's been going on for decades. We see that we need to be involved on the state level, because those are the lawmakers that are making our lives more difficult, more miserable. And if we haven't figured out how to do that, there are other folks who are going to be doing that. I just want people to like just realize that these things are connected. And under the banner of democracy right now, so the pro-democratic forces are definitely battling against the authoritarian forces. And I think we can win. We can win. This is Jamala Rogers, your host of Voices from the Battlefield. And we are here talking with Rose Brewer, Treharne Cruz, and Marika Pfeffercorn, because they've been on the battlefield. We're talking about battlefields. They've been on the battlefield of St. Paul and Minneapolis, and they're not finished. That stuff is still going on, y'all, just because it's not on the news. We got somebody talking about a damn you know, ballroom, but that's not important. What's important is the lives of our people on the streets wherever we live. And we know we got people listening from Mississippi, from Georgia. Your legislators are not stellar in terms of serving the needs of people. So I know that you probably can get some lessons here. And speaking of that, one of the things that keeps coming up to me, for me, from activists, is how did Minneapolis organize in such a way to be able to respond to what was happening? And so, because there's lessons to be learned from that, of course. Now, sometimes I hear that you all started organizing around George Floyd, and some of those networks were still in place. So I've heard of different things. So people were amazed about the level of organization, and you still talk, Marika, about some of the people are still involved in getting kids to school. So the network is still there. And you all have the January 23rd Ice Out of Minnesota Day, where, you know, people came together. You had really an amazing amount of support for that. But I was also amazed to hear that when you the research said that 80% of folks in Minnesota had heard about that action, and 25% took part of it. took part in it. So to me, 25% may seem low, but when you know that some of our voting turnout is less than 10%, that's pretty spectacular from my view as an organizer. So let's talk about how the state organized, and you all had many people that were being trained to participate in the Twin Cities, to be present, whether it be to, get people to and fro, whether it was as legal observers, but people were engaged and involved, even folks that we may not have seen when we looked at the media images. So talk a bit about what was the level of organizing. Is there a statewide group that's in process, or was it ad hoc, but you still can't were able to come together based on such a great need at that moment? Let's let our listeners know what it means to organize on the state level and bring all of that resource and attention to the Twin Cities.
Now, you know that there was Chicago and LA before there was Minneapolis.
I do.
And some of that has to do with the solidarity that was built with those cities that actually were involved in some of the insights that they garnered. And so there were conversations that did go on. I think, when you look at, it's amazing given the temperature on that day that you mentioned that tens of thousands of people came out. I consider that a mobilization. Not all of them were involved in, but I mean, it hit so close to home that people said, F it, I'm going out there and make my voice heard. As you know, as an organizer, mobilization is different from having an organized entity. Some of the entities were a part of organized efforts, including unions, but many were people who just were taking a stand. And I'll let others speak to this.
I can share a bit. I would describe it as a federation of strategies. I don't think it was, there was statewide organizationally, but like the mobilization on the ground was neighborhood by neighborhood. And using the Signal chat to connect people in those communities. Those chats and those conversations go much further back to my historical context than George Floyd. I would say Jamar Clark and the Fourth Precinct, Police Precinct, was really when Chantel Allen, others were out there and organizing. I sat by a fire outside there, and that's when relationships really started to get threaded. And there had been work before that, like folks had gone to Ferguson. And so it's a constant looping of this thread of building a circle of people that have this consciousness that we know that we need each other because the state's not going to protect us. And so they're spread out all over the place, these networks and the chats, and they were really a opportunity to dive deeper into your communities and figure out the ways that you could help beyond showing up for the general strike. The other piece that I would say is there was a lot of youth-led organizing that happened, and it started from tensions with the schools, telling them that they could not protest and they could not walk out and they could not speak up about what was happening. And a lot of their administrators were being silent as their friends were being threatened. And so young people reached out to organizers from the general strike and other places and connected to people. And school by school, they were actually organizing and had to really think about, how do we keep our most vulnerable populations protected while we're standing up for our rights and speaking out about this? So it was really a practicing and a building of that muscle, of the young people organizing and communicating with others about what was happening. The other piece that I would say is there was a lot of organizing around safety and protection. As folks are out in the streets, a lot of trainings were happening. Whether it's Cop Watch, whether it's Legal Observer, whether it's all of those pieces, these things were constantly happening, and so people could find a place where they could plug in. And those networks and those conversation places continue to exist. So I'm on like 12 different threads. And so one is like folks that are still patrolling. One is for community safety and how are we building from this and how are we taking this beyond just a reaction to, but how are we building our communities the way we want to see it, and particularly around public safety and organizing in those respects. But I know you have a lot to share as well, so I'll step back.
No, you guys are saying everything that needs to be said. Not just even I think the mutual aid aspect of it, making sure people had food because people couldn't go, didn't feel safe going to the grocery store or going to work. So there was aid to help people stay in their houses and make sure that people have food. Even during, we did a big Christmas event and had a lot of toys and had to get those to certain places to make sure people who couldn't come out could, and who still wanted some toys could get some toys. You've had to organize though too, because ICE, well, even you have people watching daycares to make sure that ICE doesn't come to the daycares. I mean, and I know that how crazy that has to sound, but ICE was actually coming to daycares and harassing people. They came to Roosevelt High School actually in pepper spray students. You know, and so the students organized a major rally and did a walkout. And even as they were walking out, I got a footage of it. You can see Homeland Security roll up on them. And I'm like, I have never, even in my life, I've never seen Homeland Security in our neighborhood, let alone, well, I might have seen them on the freeway or something, but never seen them driving in our neighborhood with their flashes on. You know, like these kids are a threat to. And they're, when they're just practicing their constitutional rights. So the students, the student walkouts, they did organize, but they were also organizing because they were impacted by what ICE was doing here in the States. So even some of the churches and stuff were having progressive churches were organizing and helping communities who were suffering during that time.
Yeah. So I think it's significant. You talked about things were in place or percolating long before this happened, even before George Floyd. When we looked at the ride down by ICE on some other communities, I did have some of the organizers from the LA area on before, because they were probably one of the first cities that got hit, obviously being so close to the border. But Marika, your point about like looping in like the what might appear to be sort of separate kinds of struggles and separate kinds of networks, I think it's so important for people to hear, because oftentimes we feel isolated, like nobody's going through this but us, and like how do we deal with this? But this stuff is so connected. ICE riding down, we know that they're here in St. Louis. They may not be in force as they are, but we got monitors out as well, and they sneaking up on folks at different places. And it is a scary thought, to Treyarch's part, that you got like armed people coming in places that are supposed to be safe, like a daycare, or going to shop for some food, or going to shop for some household goods at someplace like Home Depot. So it's very different, and I think people should understand we at a different point of time in terms of organizing and in terms of fighting for this democracy. And so it calls for different tactics, but it also calls for more organization in ways that we probably haven't done before. And I'm thinking about coming up on May Day Strong, like what it's going to look like across the country, what it's going to look like in the Twin Cities, because some of the issues might be a little bit different, but you all already had sort of what I call a dress rehearsal on January 23rd, where you had 700 businesses participate. So people are ready. I'm been talking about this, and people know I've been like anal about, okay, protest. And you said it, mobilizations are not the same as organizing. So what are you all seeing that can continue past the protest, the May Day Strong? And we want to represent, we want to say, and we want, and I keep telling people, we need to let the world know that we are in opposition to the fool in the White House and all that they're doing. We don't support any of it. And the best way to do that is for them to see us in the streets. But past that, what does organization look like? What is something past May 1st, International Workers' Day? What is it going to look like for the Twin Cities?
I suspect that people will come out in full force. There's a lot of organizing already going on for that to happen. But I'm going to follow up on your point around what is the frame we're using to talk about a real social transformation, not only in the Twin Cities, but in the country. And I also want to lift up something that Trey Hearn said about the contradictions of folk coming out in a place that is predominantly white, but not so much showing up around some of the issues that he lifted up regarding the long-term inequalities that still beset the Black communities, whether African or Black, and the kind of cudgel that this right-wing administration is using against our fellow citizens, such as the Somali population. They're using that continually. And then the fact that the state has a long history of inequality confronting Black and Brown, and especially we're on Dakota land. This is not, and I've been here a lot longer than these two people, but this struggle goes back a long way, as has been mentioned, but even before Jamar Clark. I can remember when I first arrived here in 86. So was that 40 years ago? They were fighting the police, the murder of a 14-year-old kid. And here we are again, dealing with make your connection piece, make the connections between, there is a connection between a police state that has been embraced, not maybe directly, and the killing of Black and Brown and Indigenous people. So let's go deeper. I want the mobilization. I want the message to be out there. But the organizing, we know, Jamala, that's a whole nother ball game. It's hard. And how you do it, I wish I had a magic wand to let people know. But it's daily, every day, it's political education. We got to change the frame. And I think one of the things I respect about the young organizers who took on the takeover of the Fourth Precinct and then went on to fight for other police killings is the fact that they understood that you've got to reach deep into communities. And our communities are not uniform. There are people, I'm not going to name any names, who are not fighting on this side. Anyway, I'll leave it at that. But the organizing piece, I think there's been some advance here in the city. There needs to be a lot more to deal with the contradictions that Trey Hearn put on the table.
And I want to just jump in really quickly, if that's okay. One,
Sure.
I said my mama would be upset if I did not thread the needle for the folks from Standing Rock that showed up in the Twin Cities during Operation Meso Surge, which is also an arc back to the American Indian Movement, which are also birthed here as well. And so solidarity across Black, Indigenous, everybody folk was solid. Not perfect by any means, but solid. The second piece that I think we really need to be focused on, as a follow-up to Operation Metro Surge, is the level of infrastructure for surveillance that they put into place during this time. They actually showed themselves. In the schools, they were using tapping, ICE was tapping into school cameras and using flock license plate readers to identify people. They had drones flying around the neighborhoods 24/7. And there's not this division that we believe between state and federal, because the federal government should not have had access or permission to tap into school district cameras without their knowledge or consent. Some of them gave consent, but many of them were not even aware of it. And so what I think it is a Trojan horse of, again, militarizing, bringing in these different types of technologies that have surveillance that won't just impact students that are undocumented, but marginalized communities, whether it's facial recognition technology, the cameras they have in place, the threat assessments that they have, that they literally are trying to pass down at the state legislature to do a pilot of 8 AI threat assessments for schools to prevent or keep kids safe. And yet it actually is another layer of hyper surveillance that has no evidence. It has a 50-50% chance of accuracy, but often targets Black, brown children. And so what we see is this pattern of a large surge coming in and all of this activity, but underneath there's this layer of developing deeper infrastructure for there to be a surveillance of our families, our educators, and our communities. And so that is something that we can absolutely organize against right now in Minnesota, and it's coming across every state in the country. This legislation is almost, copy and paste across the country. So what we're fighting is showing up in other communities, whether it's weapons detections or threat assessments. These technologies that are not vetted, they're biased, and actually codify historical, racial, systemic inequalities, and then step back and say, it's not us doing it. It's we caught them on camera. It's this, it's that. And so for me, that is one of the most critical takeaways out of this situation.
And before I bring Trey Harden, I do want to put a pin in this because I think what's happening now is the blurring of lines of public safety. So some people will say, don't we need that for the kids? They're being snatched and all this missing and murdered kid. Why wouldn't we want to have that technology in the schools? But what we've told people here for a long time, when the police say we want to put up cameras in your community, is those cameras are to surveil us. They're not to deal with crime on us. It's kind of like what we try to do with the whole death penalty thing, when Black people say, yeah, eye for eye. The death penalty ain't for you. Somebody to kill your brother, that they don't get the death penalty. They may not even get charged with a crime. This is for Black folks who kill white people. And if and the stats confirm that. So we are quick sometimes, just because of the nature of our communities, to say we need more police, we need more surveillance, we need, because that's going to make us safe. And that has been further from the truth. And when
It
we look
has
at
been
where those folks go to protect, it is not us. And so that education piece, Rose, that you talked about is critical right now, about surveillance. We had a community right outside of St. Louis. They told those city council people, and this is a predominantly white suburb, we don't want data centers. And they were very adamant about it, and they were protest. They went on and got signed up for the data centers. Do you know what those people got rid of? Half the city council the last election. Didn't we tell you we didn't want that? So people have to be engaged, they have to be informed, and they have to be organized. Trey Horn, you want to jump on this whole thing of surveillance and the technologies that are being used against us?
Well, I just want to thank Marika for that, because I didn't know that that happened with the school, but it makes sense and you can see it. And also, when we were indicted and arrested, I think there was a lot of technology involved in that. They used some type of phone. They used phone, some type of phone, to see people who were in the area, and they actually indicted a person who wasn't even involved in the worship or the event. And they had to drop the case against her. But definitely it's technology. And I just also, with some of them, I think we have May Day coming up, and then we have George Floyd's Angelversary is also coming up too in May. So I think people are going to start being out in the street a lot more. But yeah, just that technology. And I think some of the technology that is used on peaceful protesters and others is like military stuff that that they use on other countries and things too. So
Can you talk a little bit more about that phone technology, because you kind of swished past that. What is that about? Because we
I
all
don't
got cell phones, so that's kind of scary.
well, I don't know exactly what it's called, but I just know when I was reading in the newspaper, they talked about that technology is how they were able to indict people or say who was actually there. So I have to find out exactly more what it is, but I just, someone who was caught up in that Dragnet, her case has been dropped.
Wow. And so, Trayhorn, what would you like for the Twin Cities to look like after May Day Strong in terms of some kind of permanent organized network as opposed to one that's more reactive and more temporary? What would it look like for you? What would you hope for it to look like?
I think because there, I think it's both important. So I think something Ms. Brewer said earlier was about the occupation of the precinct. We're definitely a nonviolent movement, but when George Floyd was murdered, Derek Chauvin was arrested in 3 days. So it was there was things that happened that made it where, and then that was the first time in history. Those were kind of the first time in history, like a white cop in Minnesota was arrested for killing a black person. So I just think want to see more of the justice component. That's why I was glad that they finally brought charges against the office, agents who pointed guns at peaceful protesters. But just more mobilization around. I'm not to tell people who to vote for or anything. And I'm not definitely not to, voting solves all our problems, but I think what this administration is doing right now to our country is devastating, and we definitely need a change. And so that's November's coming up in 2026, but then having a set issues to mobilize around or to organize around coming up that are centered around reparatory justice and police accountability and ending state-sanctioned violence. I think those are really important issues to mobilize around going into going into the 2026 election and just
Well, I
actually
think,
coming
yeah, go
into.
ahead. Yeah, I think the point you make about elections is important because we know elections, they do have an impact and they make a difference. But even before then, candidates, make a difference. And so, because as we see, sometimes we are all for people and we mobilize and get them in there, and the swamp just devours them. So those people need to be coming from a space of community and connected with community, and not just to get elected, but that's going to be their how they stay grounded. And sometimes that doesn't happen. We elect them and then we say, okay, glad that's over. We got them in there, let them do their job. And but their job is very, very difficult, particularly now, and I would say especially for Democrats on the state level, because in Missouri it's a trifecta. So, we got a Republican governor, how all of it. And so to put Democrats in the state house, they need a lot of support. And so
Also,
I think we can go ahead.
and just something around the trauma that has happened too. And I think another part of
Yeah.
reparations is rehabilitation is the fourth component of UN principles on reparations. So rehabilitation is definitely needed for everybody who just, the whole Twin Cities needs some therapy right now, so.
Yeah, all of us in America of color would need it, and I can hold my hands up to say yes, we all need it, because we all involved in like trauma, not just slave post-slavery trauma, but persistent trauma every day. And so I do want to thank my guests for joining us today. We could probably have gone another hour just delving down into like what's going on there. But let's see what happens with May Day Strong, what it like presents for us, to us, and how we can build off of that. Next week, y'all, I will not be here. I will be in court. As you know, I am one of the plaintiffs in Rogers versus the state of Missouri, where we are fighting for local control of the police department that was snatched from us by this red legislature. And I just got a note from somebody that says that my other plaintiff, Mike Milton, with the Freedom Center, the police board is saying that we're bullying them. And look at me. Do I look like a bully, y'all? So the organizing and the narratives, they are feeling the pressure, but we will be in court in Jefferson City next Wednesday, so we won't have it. And the first Wednesday of the month is always blackcommentator.com, where we bring on some of the writers there, so they won't be here. But I would ask and encourage you to go to blackcommentator.com and read some of the commentary that some of us have written about a number of things, and so we want you to zero in on that. There's a lot going on, y'all. We are under siege. We are in bad need of organization and support and loving on one another, because this is not going to get easier. It's going to get harder. And so we want to make sure that we stay connected. And I'd love to hear from you all, Minneapolis folks, after May Day Strong and after some of those court cases to see what's going on. But this is where we are. This is Jamala Rogers, your host of Voices from the Battlefield, and I will see you in the battlefield. And the next one will be the legal battlefield, Jeff City, May 6th, Jamala Rogers versus the state of Missouri. Stay tuned.
We've got to do it right. Stop the fussing and the fighting.